content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. So let's start with a very short article here about how to be resourceful as you reach retirement. And this was from the London Times. It's a well-planned retirement. Outside England's Bristol Zoo, there is a parking lot for 150 cars and 8 buses. For 25 years, its parking fees were managed by a very pleasant attendant. The fees for cars, $1.40, for buses, about $7. Then one day, after 25 solid years of never missing a day of work, he just didn't show up. So the zoo management called the city council and asked them to send them another parking agent. The council did some research and replied that the parking lot was the zoo's own responsibility. The zoo advised the council that the attendant was a city employee. The city council responded that the lot attendant had never been on the city payroll. Meanwhile, sitting in his villa somewhere on the coast of Spain or France or maybe Italy is a man who had apparently had a ticket booth installed completely on his own and then had simply begun to show up every day, commencing to collect and keep the parking fees, estimated at about $560 per day for 25 years. Assuming 7 days a week, this amounts to just over $7 million. And no one even knows his name. Now, moving on to an article from Health Immunity magazine. We started this article last time, How Exercise Boosts Immunity. What's the best type of exercise to boost your immunity? Many studies, including Neiman's, looked at aerobic activity. Think walking, running, or cycling. To gain the benefits, it's best to push the pace a bit when walking. For most people, we're talking about a 15-minute mile. Neiman says of the average pace that led to promising results in his studies. That's sufficient stimulus to recruit immune cells into circulation. For other forms of exercise, aim to reach about 60% of your VO2 max or about 70% of your max heart rate, Neiman suggests. There's less science on high-intensity interval training workouts, or HIIT, a popular type of exercise, and whether they help your immunity. One small study from 2018 in the journal Arthritis Research and Therapy, focusing on arthritis patients, said that HIIT could improve immune function, whereas a small 2014 study in the Journal of Inflammation Research found that HIIT workouts don't lower immunity. In general, Neiman says interval workouts are likely okay. Our bodies are used to this back-and-forth nature, even for a few hours, as long as it's not unrelenting, high-intensity exercise, he says. The same goes for strength training. It likely helps your immune system, but there's less research and recent studies backing up its benefits on immunity. Adam Jechner, Ph.D., CSCS, Assistant Professor of Exercise Science and Physiology at Kent State University, who has also studied exercise and the immune response, touts resistance training as a strategy for improving immunity. However, he cautions against severe muscle-damaging workouts, like lifting super heavy weights or doing eccentric exercises, slowing down the downward phase of a movement, so that the muscle repair process doesn't compete with your immune function. So if you're worried about immunity, it may not be the best time to start a workout like CrossFit. Can exercise harm your immune system? Like all good things in life, you can overdo exercise, science says. Pushing yourself too hard for too long can actually put you at higher risk of infection. But you have to go pretty far past that acute level of training to experience negative side effects. For example, most studies that found that extreme exercise can increase risk of illness examined marathon runners, like Niemann's 1990 study published in the Journal of Sports Medicine and Physical Fitness. But Niemann says this negative effect can come into play if you're running at a high intensity for at least a half marathon distance, or cycling or swimming at a tough pace for 90 minutes. Any of these longer, more intense activities can cause stress on the body that could lead to lower immune function. You put yourself in a stressful state, so your immune system reflects that and leads to dysfunction that can last anywhere from a few hours to a few days, Niemann says. Basically, high-intensity activity for more than an hour might not be the best idea if you're really focusing on keeping your immune system in top shape. Jatner agrees that spending weeks incorporating super high-intensity workouts into your schedule could backfire. If you're looking at exercise in a chronic sense, there's something referred to as the J curve. Over time, as you continue to exercise at a moderate intensity for weeks to months, your risk for infection will decrease, said Jatner. But if you do excessive and intense exercise, you increase risk of infection. Exactly how long and how hard you can push yourself before you reach that excessive and intense level of exercise ultimately comes down to how well you've trained. But you might want to focus on maintenance rather than intensity in these pandemic times. Moderate intensity is the best route for now, but maintaining that activity in some form or fashion is going to be the key. The bottom line, moderate exercise can boost your immunity right now, but don't overdo it. If you're feeling sick at all, don't work out. Get better first, then try to work exercise back into your routine. Niemann views time at home as a golden opportunity to start a regular walking program, a time to nail down the habit of frequent physical activity. While other lifestyle habits like eating fruit, managing stress, and getting quality sleep can also help reduce risk of illness. Niemann says exercise is potentially the most powerful habit that people can adopt right now. If you're super new to exercise and have your doc's approval to start a fitness program, Jatner suggests going out for even just 10 minutes, 2 to 4 times a day. Then work on gradually increasing that time, or try a low-impact workout at home if you're in a crowded city and have fewer opportunities to get outdoors. Now let's move on to AARP, the magazine. Be your own money manager. We started this last time, and we may continue it for several times because it's a lengthy article with several sections. Selling your home, filing your taxes, growing your savings. Thanks to new technology and tools, you no longer need paid professionals to handle your transactions and tasks. Meet people who have taken control of their personal business and see how you can do it too. This is on taxes. You're the tax man. Preparing your own return may be easier than you think. It's cheaper too. And this is by Stephanie Allwerter. What if, gulp, the best person to prepare your taxes was you? More than half of filers pay to have their taxes done. A basic return costs nearly $200 on average. But if your finances are simple, why not do it yourself? Most people don't need extra help, says Barbara Weltman, an editor at the J.K. Lasser Institute, a tax advice publisher. What they need, she says, is confidence. So grab your W-2 or your SSA 1099 and take some deep cleansing breaths with these 5 steps. You've got this. Pick your program. Gone are the days of pencil, paper, and complex tables. Nearly 90% of tax returns are prepared and filed electronically now, and for good reason. The software is good, error rates are low, and your refund, if you're due one, arrives faster. You shouldn't have to pay much for software or at all. Credit Karma, creditkarma.com/tax, lets you prepare and file state and federal returns for free in return for targeted ads and offers. You also might be eligible for software through the IRS Free File Program, irs.gov/free file. You typically qualify if your total income minus retirement plan contributions is $72,000 or less. State returns might require a small fee. Collect paperwork. Look at prior year's federal and state returns, says Mary Geong, a certified public accountant in Piedmont, California. This will point you to the information you need for this year's return, particularly if not much changed for you financially in 2020 or whatever year. Next, gather your new documents. This includes wage and income statements, such as your W-2, if you had employment income, 1099 forms for investment income, freelance work, Social Security and retirement account withdrawals, and records of any retirement account contributions. If you need additional documents, your software will tell you this. Know what's new. The federal government has rolled out some new tax breaks for the 2020 tax year, including a $300 deduction for cash contributions to charities, even if you don't itemize deductions. Also, you can now make traditional IRA contributions past age 70 and a half, provided you had earned income during the year. Then dive in. You don't need to be a numbers person, said Weltman. No need to be in fear. Most tax prep programs operate interview style, guiding you step by step through the data that you need to enter. All you have to do is type in the numbers and other information. The program does all the math. It will even flag possible input errors. Then get help if necessary. If you're stuck or simply have nagging doubts that something isn't right, free help is available. AARP Foundation Tax Aid, AARP.org/tax aid, can assist in a safe, socially distanced way. The IRS can also help via its Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, that's VITA, which offers help to those earning $57,000 or less, or its Tax Counseling for the Elderly, TCE, service for those age 60 and older. And that's at irs.treasury.gov/free tax prep. If you have trouble getting the help you need in time, use IRS Form 4868 to get an automatic 6-month filing extension. Though if you don't pay any taxes due by April 15th, you may owe penalties and interest on your ultimate tax bill. So, for the most part, this is past the tax filing period this year, but it's good information for next year or if you have asked for an extension. Now let's move on to an article also in AARP, the magazine, Breaking the Silence. For 4 years, Tony Bennett and his family have kept his secret. Now they have decided the truth must be told. This is quite a lengthy article, and we will probably spread it over several weeks. Part 1. It's just another gift. On an afternoon in early November, I arrived at Tony Bennett's home on the 15th floor of a high-rise on the southern edge of New York City's Central Park. The sprawling 3-bedroom apartment's wall of windows opens on a heart-stopping view of the park and floods the rooms with a steady northern light. A painter's dream, as Bennett once said, which matters because, as well as being one of the world's greatest singers, he is also a serious visual artist. Over the last quarter century, he has spent untold hours in his sanctuary, a converted bedroom turned art studio, where I was brought to meet him by his wife, Susan. This was clearly the space of a working artist. The walls, papered with sketches, a messy table heaped with brushes, and curled paint tubes, an easel by the window holding a work in progress, a black and white drawing of the park, the distant buildings expertly evoked with impressionistic flicks of charcoal. Bennett himself was seated at a desk along one wall, his chair turned toward the windows as he paged slowly through a coffee table book open on his lap. Natalie dressed in a blue blazer over an open collar shirt, dark slacks, and white running shoes, he was, at 94, startlingly youthful in appearance, and instantly recognizable. The blue, heavy-lidded eyes, the iconic Roman nose, the coiffed salt-and-pepper hair. Missing, however, was the easy, ever-present smile that helped brand him the nice guy, singing idol of his generation. More approachable than the volatile Sinatra or the jokingly drunken Dean Martin, instead, his expression had a mask-like impassivity that changed only slightly to dim awareness when Susan, a slim, fine-featured 54-year-old, placed a hand on his shoulder, leaned over, and said, "This is John Tone. He's come to talk to us about the new album." She spoke into his ear, a little loudly perhaps, in a prompting, emphatic register, as if trying to reach her husband through a barrier that had fallen between him and the rest of the world. Indeed she was. He looked expressionlessly, no expression, into my eyes before returning wordlessly to his book. Tony Bennett has Alzheimer's disease, the most common form of age-related dementia. Alzheimer's is characterized by a progressive memory loss that robs its sufferers of many of the gifts that we all take for granted: speech, understanding, treasured memories, recognition of loved ones, and leaves them utterly dependent on caregivers. Bennett, first diagnosed in 2016, has so far been spared the disorientation that can prompt patients to wander from home, as well as the episodes of terror, rage, or depression that can accompany Alzheimer's frightening detachment from reality. And indeed, he might never develop these symptoms. But there was little doubt that the disease had progressed. Even his increasingly rare moments of clarity and awareness reveal the depth of his debility. At one point, as Susan and I stood chatting, he looked up suddenly from the book in his lap and, flashing that familiar smile, asked me in his soft, suede whisper, "How the weather outside?" Had I not known that he and Susan had just returned from walking their dog in the park, I might not have suspected that anything was amiss. Such short-term memory loss is a hallmark of Alzheimer's, stealthy onset. But long-term memories also progressively vanish, which lent an extra poignancy to the fact that the picture book that so gripped his attention was Tony Bennett on stage and in the studio from 2018, a lavishly illustrated volume that featured photos from every stage of his life, from babyhood onward. He stared into its pages, not with the air of warm reminiscence, but like a man struggling to recall why these images seem familiar. Although he can still recognize family members, he is, according to Susan, not always sure where he is or what is happening around him. Mundane objects, as familiar as a fork or a set of house keys, can be utterly mysterious to him. 10 minutes into my visit, Tony's eldest son, Danny, joined us in the studio. "Hey, Pop," he said. Tony glanced up with a slight smile and a nod before returning silently to his picture book. Danny, an affable 66-year-old in black jeans and a Nehru-style jacket, had acted as his father's manager for the past 40 years. He was crucial to the mid-1990s career rebirth that made Tony, then in his late 60s, an unlikely staple of MTV, and which culminated in a 1994 Best Album Grammy for Tony Bennett, MTV Unplugged. Since then, Danny has masterminded a steady stream of memorable duet recordings featuring Tony and John Mayer, K.D. Lang, James Taylor, Sting, the late Amy Winehouse, and Lady Gaga, who has become a devoted protege. Their first electrifying duet, The Lady is a Tramp, in 2011, proved to be a life-changing moment for Gaga when the 20-something glam rock techno pop star realized under Tony's tutelage that she was, like him, also a jazz singer. Someone who can riff off a melody easily, improvising harmonic detours of stunning beauty. The fact that Tony sees me as a natural-born jazz singer is still something that I haven't gotten over, Gaga said recently. In 2014, Lady Gaga and Tony recorded Cheek to Cheek, an album of standards that debuted at number one on Billboard's top 200 pop and rock chart, the kind of intergenerational success that simply cannot be ignored. Soon, a follow-up was being discussed. The songs were recorded in widely spaced sessions between 2018 and early 2020. After a number of delays owing to Gaga's burgeoning film stardom in A Star is Born and solo recording career, including the release of her recent LPs, Joan and Chromatica, to say nothing of the COVID-19 pandemic, the collaboration is finally being prepared for release this spring. Tony was already showing clear signs of the disease, Susan said, when he and Gaga started recording the new LP at New York's Electric Lady Studios 2 years after his diagnosis. Indeed, Susan was not entirely sure that Tony was up to the task. "We'll try," she recalled telling Danny. "That's all I can tell you. We'll try." So we'll move on now to another article, but we will catch up with that one again next time. This one is Doug Shadell, Outsmart Fraud, the Catfish Hunter, Tales and Advice from an Expert Screener of Online Dating Scams. David McLellan was doing just fine professionally as an online marketing consultant in 2013 when he first saw the MTV reality show Catfish. The series features people who innocently develop relationships with others online only to discover the person is a scammer. At first, McLellan watched the show just for entertainment. It wasn't until his customers started asking him how they, too, could avoid being caught in a romance scam that he sensed an opportunity. So he and his partner launched Social Catfish, a website that helps you learn about that person you met online. 7 years later, McLellan and his partner had a healthy enterprise. Then the pandemic hit, and healthy became booming as people stuck at home turned to the internet to meet new people and pass the time. Calls and emails to the AARP Fraud Watch Network confirm a recent surge in romance scams targeting older Americans. How do background check firms like Social Catfish, Ben Verified, and Truthfinder help? For a small monthly fee, customers can access tools that help people's background information be located, such as former addresses and employment history. Plus, some sites have a reverse image search function. Customers can upload a photo to check whether it's authentic. Social Catfish, which specializes in romance scams, additionally offers a more costly service. You can hire a staffer to research and create a full report on the person in question. I asked McLellan how his customers break down between men and women, and he said that subscribers are split roughly 50-50. Clearly, we're all vulnerable. I also asked what percentage of the people his business investigates turn out to be scammers. About 70%, he said, pointing out that most of his clients turn to his firm only when they see a red flag. Usually, this is a request for money. Clues of fraud can be easy to spot. To start, many romance scammers use the same fake photos. Often, he said, they'll steal pics of attractive people in military uniforms or porn stars, dressed, of course, or popular posters on social networks. The commonality? All have proven that they'll draw lots of eyeballs. McClellan added that scammers use the same scripts with the same canned phrases over and over. And he said it's not uncommon for scammers to be involved with several victims at one time and to spend hours on the phone with the same person. They see it as a full-time job. What do they talk about for that long time? Monica Whitty, an Australian social psychologist, has published papers outlining how romance scammers groom victims by showering them with compliments, sending love poems, professing their undying support, and even mailing small gifts with love notes attached. Some experts refer to this as love bombing. The goal is to get the victim so infatuated with the scammer, or more accurately, the character he or she portrays, that the victim will be more likely to say yes when asked for money. In past interviews, scammers have told me they wait until the victim has clearly fallen for them to make their move. Even then, they never ask for money outright. It's always a loan or a temporary advance to get them out of a one-time and surely fake jam. That makes it seem less risky. Most people lose only a couple of $100s and then wise up. But we also have clients who have lost hundreds of thousands, McClellan noted. Either way, it's a double loss, financial and emotional. For some, learning their love interest is not real can be the bigger hurt. I asked McClellan what new twists he's seeing. Scammers are moving beyond dating sites to online games where you can play with people you don't know, he said. Over time, the scammer will identify vulnerable people and befriend them. McClellan doesn't say to give up on meeting people online. Just do your due diligence and independently verify whom you're talking to before making any commitments, and never send them money. Never. We have time for a few little crazy little thing called scam. Posing as military, scammers fake being overseas soldiers who, after establishing a relationship, claim some kind of hardship requiring money. Gaming game players, crooks connect with people playing online games and then move conversations to a private chat room to grow the bond. Focusing on guys, romance scams are gender neutral. About half of McClellan's clients are male, but pitches to guys are usually more sexual. Preying on insecurities, beauty enhancement, photo filters are on the rise. Scammers may see users as high potential targets. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.